You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Chris Burns. Glad to see all of you here today, that you made it through the rain. And let's get this show started. You might know me from my Euronews show, The Network. Three people, 10 minutes, start a fight or a lively discussion. We hope to have a lively discussion today that involves not only the panel, but you. And we're looking at crunch time, a crunch moment. No, it's not Thursday. We all know about Thursday. It's about next month. And it's about decarbonizing transport. There will be a communication by the European Commission. And we're all on the edge of our seats. Those of us who are involved in this issue, we're on the edge of our seats to find out what the Commission is going to come up with in their communication. How are we going to decarbonize transport with the commitments we made in Paris, with the commitments that the EU has made on its own, the 2030 commitments? How do you turn around an aircraft carrier, if you allow me to use that metaphor, an aircraft carrier with 500 million people on it and millions of cars? How are we going to do this? You have to be realistic. You have to hope you save as many jobs as you can and create as many jobs as you can. So let's hear it from each of the panelists, beginning with Gesine Meissner. Entschuldigung. Nee, ich bin auch Berliner. A member of the European Parliament Committee on Transport and Tourism, and you were shadow rapporteur of a sustainable urban mobility last year. So very well plugged into this issue. Gesine, bitte.
Okay. It wasn't only that. I was shadow rapporteur two times on white paper of transport and of alternative fuel strategy. So that's all on decarbonizing, of course, in general. And I'm a member of the environmental committee as well. That's a good mixture maybe for transport. But right now, if it comes to my time is running, I know, decarbonizing Europe's road transport, I think we have to think about direct actions or measures and indirect ones. I'll start with the direct ones. Of course, we need to think about our standards. And right now, I'm a member of the inquiry committee as well. We have to look for real driving emission and to look for PEMs to really figure out what are the real emissions, not only CO2. Of course, we want to reduce NOx as well, just to mention this. And we have to figure out what is possible and what is achievable and what are we longing for. Second thing is intelligent transport system that should be by far more delivered, because it's better traffic flow, it's less congestion and everything of that kind. And it helps a lot of decarbonizing the road transport. 28 projects of the CEF projects that had been financed right now up to now out of 195 really are dedicated to intelligent transport services. Electromobility is a thing, of course, to think about, but it's a question where, what is the source for the electricity? Is it a sustainable source or is it not? That's very important for me. And, of course, other alternative energy is important. We have had this clean power of transport strategy, and the implementation, of course, is very important. Right now, for example, LNG regarding ships, and it could be used for trucks as well, is a little bit slowed down because the oil price is so low, but I don't want to say that the oil price must be higher, but it's really a case that it wasn't delivered as fast as it could be. We need a network in place for hydrogen and everything in order to sell better plug-in hybrids and other more sustainable kind of cars, and electromobility, of course, as well. LNG, I mentioned already, we need an infrastructure not only for vessels but for trucks as well. CNG for cars, I don't like that much, but I mentioned it because it's a kind of decarbonizing as well. Autonomous driving could help us forward as a direct action, and because people say it's safer and it has less emissions because it's more efficiently driven, usually if you have an autonomous driven car. Shared economy, of course, shared cars in cities are a good action to have less cars in place. And the last mile of transport is very important for me. I think it could be that you have in future, in the last mile of delivery, self-driving Uber or whatever. So shared economy combined with maybe self-driving cars with the alternative energy would be by far a better solution than we have right now. Or even it could be drones. And then it's a question, how are the drones? Yeah, how do they fly? With what do they fly? Trucks, of course, we always will need trucks in future, I'm absolutely convinced, but we are always already talking about platooning of trucks to have it more efficient. And I'm a defender of longer trucks. I know not everybody in the room does like them, but I'm absolutely convinced in Lower Saxony where we test them. In certain parts of the road, longer trucks, if you have two trucks instead of three, it's less carbon, and then, of course, it could be better. And, last but not least, urban mobility, of course, is a very big chance. In urban mobility, you can by far save still more emissions than, for example, in regional areas with e-bikes and everything. And we have indirect actions as well. For me, they are equally important, although they don't sound like a road decarbonizing at the first sight. For example, we need more inland waterways. By far, we can have much more freight, for example, on vessels than we have right now on trucks. And that's something we have to work on. That's what we do with the CEF, the Connecting Europe Facility, to have more inland waterways, to have more intermodal hubs. So 40 projects of CEF went to intermodal hubs for intermodality and modal shift. And, for example, right now, a reason for having so many trucks on road and not to have the freight on rail is, for example, as well that on road usually you have trailers, and trailers can't be easily put on rail. So you need a certain technology to put trailers, for example, on rail. There are technologies in place like RailRunner and cargo beamer. I don't want to make advertisement right now, but several technical solutions are in place, but they are not used yet. And of course, we could have by far more freight from road to rail. Self-driving trains with platooning could be another solution in future, right? Not right now, next year, but there were already tests on metros, autonomously driven, and there were more efficient and more energy efficient and less emitting, of course. And the last point I want to mention is integrated ticketing. It doesn't sound like road as well, but it was refused. We didn't get it through in our railway package. I really regret it a lot, because if you, for example, want to fly from A to B in Europe, you can just put it into your computer and you will have a lot of offer. Cheap ones, long ones, expensive ones, and you can choose. If you want to do the same thing with rail, you can't do it, because we don't have a system, even not for information, throughout Europe. And I know that sometimes you always have something about, for example, in Germany, Deutsche Bundesbahn, that I have an app and I always can figure out. But you don't have it for cheaper private companies who maybe offer better prices for you, but you don't know about it. And so sometimes people take the car instead of the train, and that can't be changed. I hope that were 5 minutes and not more.
Thank you very much, Gesine. One quick question. You've given us a whole palette of different measures. My head is spinning. It's amazing how many, all this innovation. But if there could be one of those things in this communication next month, what would you like to see? What would be the most important to you?
Maybe first the infrastructure for alternative energy, because it's by far not that far implemented as it could be. But it's difficult to decide. I hope it was the right one.
Okay. All right, let's move on to Joachim Lutz, CEO of Krupp Energies and member of the Board of Directors of the European Renewable Ethanol Association, or EPUR. Joachim, we discussed a little bit earlier that you see your industry, is it working?
No.
Okay, I can pass to you. Your industry as a bridge technology, but also as a longer-term technology. How long-term?
Thank you. So the topic we are here is climate change, which has consequences on the income distribution worldwide. Globally, so not only here, but in other countries with migration effects and all that connected to that. I don't want simply to put it down and boil it down to a 2 degrees a question to say whether we meet it or not. So in Europe, there's a good progress. What is concerned with the reduction of carbon dioxide. That's okay, with the exception, with one exception, this is traffic. That's the transportation sector, where we indeed, over the last couple of years, have even an increase and not a decrease. So the EU understood that, and we need action here, and I think we agree with the European Commission to say, to do something. But the targets we have right now, the 2020 targets are, let me say, are pretty cloudy. They are so-called technology neutral, with the effect that we do not get it on the road. We get an improvement not on the road. And if we come to your question to say, is it a bridge technology? I would say, I don't know what happens in the year 2050. In 2050, maybe when I came here this morning, a lot of traffic jams. I cannot imagine that with more and more cars this will go on for the next couple of decades. Maybe we have a completely different infrastructure. You mentioned that. And in that wake, I'm not sure whether really Crop Energies exists and produces, exists, yes, but produces maybe an alternative to oil. Certainly is that in, by the year 2050, we will not have very much oil for the next generation. We'll ask, what have you done with the oil? Fossil oil, you can do much more valuable thing. So what we need concrete, what the demand of our industry is, what are the options to replace fossil oil, which means fossil emissions and greenhouse gas emissions. We have the alternative to oil. The industry capacity easily cover 10% of that. And if you look at the fleet and the infrastructure we have right now here, I just heard the figure 240 or 280 million cars here. At least two-thirds of them are gasoline cars, not as for many percepted. Usually you say most of it is diesel. No, the other way around. I'm not talking about diesel. I'm talking about gasoline and the replace gasoline by bioethanol. That's our business, and I think the capacity of the industry has sustainably produced gasoline, ethanol, to mix it and blend it with ethanol. And our demand and our wish should be, please prolong after the year 2020 the 10% renewable energy target. That's the first thing. The second thing is allocate a specific industry transportation specific target of greenhouse gas reduction of 12%. Why do we do that? Why do I promote that? For I think all other options like ETS or upstream emission or double counting just lead to keep the fossil oil consumption up and do not give any progress to us.
Okay. Very good. Joachim, thank you very much. Let us move on to Frank Overmeyer, Senior Manager for Emissions and Safety Passenger Vehicles at Daimler's External Affairs. Frank, millions of cars on the road. How are we going to make this conversion without your industry coming under further pressure, regulatory pressure, to change faster?
Yes, so thank you very much. Since I'm a strategist, I'm always looking at this from a strategic perspective. And the first thing I would like to do is I need to set this into the whole context. So, I mean, the invitation here clearly shows that if you or we are talking about road transportation, this is always passenger cars. This is not the rest of the transport sector, and we will talk this evening, I guess, about cars. So I'm a tinkerer, and I tinkered a little bit because usually I'm doing PowerPoint presentations with animations. So now you get an animation from me. So we are talking here about this part here. This is passenger cars. And this is the animation, because this is this 240 million of vehicles. This is the existing car park we need to optimize. And this piece here on the top, this is the new cars. So you are asking me now, how can we accelerate this, that this small piece here is eating up the rest like a Pac-Man much faster? I mean, this is not only in the hands of the automotive industry. This is specifically depending on the situation around. We are now at the point where we have a paradigm shift. We will now need to switch from conventional driving to electric driving. And this only can work if the surroundings and if the environment works in a proper way. So infrastructure, and I fully concur with what Gesine said, infrastructure planning, infrastructure availability is the key for the success. It's not only the industry that is providing vehicles. If you cannot charge, it will not work. And it does not make sense cars without infrastructure. It does not make sense infrastructure without cars. And it does not make sense electric cars driving with electricity from coal power plants. So renewable energy is also necessary. Additional renewable energy, electricity from renewable sources. Only then it makes sense. And only then this new car park is running in a way that it's sustainable. And this is such a big challenge that I already said it to Alexandre before. I'm so happy that the new Directorate General is now combining climate and energy, because this is a challenge, not only setting technical targets, saying, well, in 2030, the target is 50 grams CO2 for the new cars. This is not the important thing. The important thing that this all fits together, and they can set targets that the infrastructure fits to the electric vehicles, and we have to provide the vehicles for the infrastructure. Just imagine one point in time we will achieve that all the new cars are electric driving. This is 12 million new cars a year. And if we then assume that only 5 drivers share commonly one charging point, that means that we need 2.5 million new charging points every year for the next 20 years. That means in working days, every day, 10,000 new charging points, 20 years' time without any delay. That is the challenge. We have to make a significant transition from a world with pumps and gasoline stations to charging, fast charging, home charging, workplace charging everywhere, and provide in the same progress of 5% new electric vehicles every year, getting the necessary renewable energy. That is the real challenge. Focusing only on targets for automotive industry is absolutely insufficient. Thank you.
Frank, are you telling me that the 2030 targets are impossible?
They are not impossible. We don't know them. So for the auto industry, we don't know them. If we know that we get a technical target, for us it's clear that we have to provide a significant share, up to 100%, if you will, electric vehicles until 2030. But if for these vehicles the necessary frame conditions are not being set and the electricity, the energy is not there, then this is worth nothing.
Okay, point taken. I know Pete Harrison, Program Director for Transport at the European Climate Foundation. You're also, in so doing, you're the expert on low-carbon transport. I mean, we might even start the debate now, but I know you want to make your statement as well, but it sounds rather gloomy to me.
Yeah, well, it is the climate challenge, and we don't pretend it's not challenging. But just to talk about it from the other side, in Paris, there was an agreement to limit global temperature increases to 1.5 degrees or well below 2 degrees. And I think people underestimate what that really means, the difference of that nuance from 2 degrees to well below 2 degrees or even 1.5 degrees. But that is what's necessary to avert, you know, some of these catastrophic impacts, which we're already starting to witness the first signs of what that promises. And what that really means to achieve those kind of levels is a move beyond incrementalism. In the past, we've been thinking, okay, let's do the cheap and easy stuff first. Basically, to achieve well below 2 degrees, you've got to do everything and you've got to do it fast, all at once. Now, putting that into the context of transport, today the European Environment Agency published new figures for 2014 showing that now transport is not the second largest source of emissions in Europe. It is the single biggest source of emissions in Europe. It has eclipsed the power sector. And so not only do you have to do everything fast all at once across society, but you've got to do it extra fast in transport. And it's not just about CO2. There are other products of combustion, of fossil fuels, which are also a problem. Today, Also another interesting statistics published by Santé Publique France, that 48,000 people a year end their lives prematurely because of the other products of combustion, NOx and particulates. And to put that at the European level, that's 400,000 a year. Now, that's the gloomy side of it. The good news is that the technologies are here. They're available. You can go out. You can buy a hybrid car, which is a hell of a lot more efficient than your standard version. And electric cars are out there today. And the technologies are getting rapidly cheaper. We're starting to see a curve like the curve we saw for solar technologies. So the technologies are out there. And if we think about deploying those in at a rate that is compliant with well below 2 degrees, there are many co-benefits. We cut that air pollution that I talked about, and we can cut it by 40% by 2030. So, you know, that's the promise that the policymakers have in front of them. If they do their job properly, we can cut that by 40% at the same time as keeping the carbon emissions on a 2 degrees compliant pathway. At the same time, we can cut spending on imported oil by about 55 billion euros a year. That's excluding tax. Yeah. Now, already, we're going to capture 33 billion of that avoided spending simply by enacting the 95 grams, which has already been agreed. But we have to enforce that. Yeah. That's the problem. While policymakers have been doing a reasonable job on the efficiency in Brussels, there's been lax enforcement by authorities all around Europe. So we have to enforce the standards we set. And then finally, by moving from a system that's very heavy on operating expenses, from an oil-based system, we're going to be spending more on vehicle technologies, which are always produced close to market. So that's spending in the European economy. At the same time, as we move to electrification, what we're doing is we're moving to a system where we're moving away from imported energy towards domestically produced energy. That also creates jobs and growth. Now, at some point, the oil industry will stand up and they'll say, oh, yeah, well, electrification, very expensive. Now, it may look expensive. They know how to make it look expensive by ascribing all of those costs to the single benefit of carbon abatement. No doubt they go to venues where people are talking about air pollution and they ascribe all of the costs to the single benefit of NOx pollution. But the fact is, if you divide the cost of electrification across all of those multiple benefits, yeah, energy security, economic resilience, better air, cleaner air, less health costs, less noise pollution, even less cleaning of the buildings that are, you know, blackened through diesel emissions around Brussels. If you divide the cost across those, suddenly electrification is a very good deal. So my message to the audience is, you know, let's not get distracted by protecting outdated technologies. Let's focus on the benefits that are there to be grasped within this next session of policy making. Thank you.
And does this, Pete, does this need to be done with a carrot or a stick? Or both, and how?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I do sympathize with the car industry when they say it's all stick and there's not enough carrot. Frankly, you need a CO2 labeling system for cars that works. You need incentives in the early days, but actually in the long term you need to get your taxation right on energy so that you've got a more sustainable transition, and you need to do something very serious about rolling out the infrastructure. And I totally agree with Frank. It's a challenge, but it's less of a challenge than living with climate change.
Thank you, Peter. Alexandre Pacot, you have a report that's coming out next month. We got journalists in the room. And just between you and me, can you at least say it will include carrots and sticks? Or and how can you respond to all of this pressure we've just heard on you and your DG, which is you are head of road transport at the European Commission Directorate General for Climate Action, the lightning rod?
Yes. Thanks a lot for putting me in such an easy situation. So I'm not going to reveal like a big secret from how we are preparing this this transport decarbonization communication, but just let me say a few words about the challenge that we are facing. You know, transport sector represents about one fourth of the total greenhouse gas emissions. This is a sector where emission has not decreased as much as in the rest of the economy. So it is a challenge that we are facing to see reduction of emissions in the transport sector, but it's also an opportunity. And I think the future communication is likely to stress these opportunities in terms of jobs, growth for the whole EU economy. So what we're also going to look at is how the transport sector can help delivering a cost-effective reduction of emissions to meet EU 2030 and longer targets. We will also have in July this package including targets for member states for the non-ETS sector. And that will include, of course, the transport sector. Another important message is we will not look at transport measures in isolation, but of course in a very integrated way. And of course, the colleagues from Daimler is right by pointing that it is not just targeting one particular sector, one particular measure, but really a mix of policy instruments. And also a partnership of action, for action. So it's not only EU level measures, but it's also national measures, local measures. We hear a lot about infrastructures, and we know that this is not only an EU action. We need also a lot of action by many actors. And if we look at this integrated approach, you know that this is mainly covering three aspects. First of all, the efficiency of the vehicles, which is a very important driver for cutting emissions. We've seen that with the CO2 regulation for cars and vans. And there will be also standards for the future. So I can reassure my colleague on the right, there will be standards in the future. But of course, we need still to prepare them and propose them for next year. Also, looking at what the challenges of cutting emission in the transport sector, this will require a bigger penetration of low-emission vehicles. So here I'm talking about zero-emission vehicles, but also plug-in hybrids. So we need clearly stronger deployment of this type of vehicles. So that's the first aspect. The second element is fuels. Of course, we need to continue to decarbonize fuel, and that means low-emission fuels being incentivized and looking at electrification, but also advanced biofuels. And finally, looking at the management of road transport activity, here a lot of, course, action are being taken, but some more action could be needed, for instance, on the intelligent transport system, as you were referring to. Final point, this needs, of course, some cross-cutting support, and I think infrastructure has been said already a lot, and the communication will look into that. But also, my message is also looking at the opportunities for growth and jobs. I think this is not just about cutting emissions, it's also about creating innovation and growth for Europe.
I mean, I've heard people talk about how, you know, if you thought about it at the turn of the last century, when cars were just getting going, I mean, in the early 1900s, people were, how could people have imagined that there would be so many gas stations on, you know, virtually every other corner? Well, that's something we have to imagine now for the new kind of technology that's going to be used. But are you still, I mean, the way that... the way that Frank portrayed it, how are you going to meet that demand in time if you're going to build cars like that that are going to need that kind of recharge? How are you going to do that? It seems impossible at the rate he's talking about.
But I think here what you were saying about, here we talk about new vehicles. It's true that with new vehicles we only target a small proportion of the current fleet, but the fleet of today. But the fleet in 2030 will very much depend on the cars which are today put on the market. So if we don't have the right type of powertrains which are put on the market today, how are we going to meet our longer-term targets? Mm-hmm. That's a bit the message.
That's a big question. Do we have the mics ready in case we have a question here? But before we go to one question, I got one question for Joachim. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, I kind of perked my ears up when I heard from Alex among other things, the decarbonization of fuel and advanced biofuels. Okay, great. That's more expensive, probably. What about with these low oil prices? Doesn't that make it very difficult for your industry to adapt?
I think generally, of course, if the fossil oil prices are low or very low, as they have been a year ago, people tend to say, well, okay, the reserves seem not too small, and it's bigger than thought, and the target of decarbonizing transport is somewhat delayed. But I'm pretty sure fossil oils and resources are limited. And at a certain time in the future, we have better uses without that. Of course, however, I think we have additional benefits, so we cannot be directly compared to oil, so fossil oil. If we talk about biofuels, particularly bioethanol, that means we have right now not be very much more expensive than the gasoline price today, but we have a large benefit, carbon dioxide reduction of more than 60%. That's the EU average, what we have. It doesn't matter whether it's conventional or advanced biofuels. Just to make a sentence to that, there will be no advanced biofuels without having introduced the conventional one, for the infrastructure is just there. We have the strictest limitations and certification schemes here in Europe regarding carbon dioxide emissions on our fuels. Sometimes I have the impression they're even more than baby food. But it's okay, we can cope with that if we have a competition on that side. So oil, fossil oil price is for me not so the major concern, but we need a policy which says we would like to have a decarbonization. And clean air, not only carbon dioxide, NOx, and all these things concern everybody of us. And it's a public good. Anybody can pollute. So the governments, so the regulator, have to put some efforts in that. That means you have to put X, Y, Z percent of the energy in that. And I think in that efforts, all three stakeholder can take participate in that. The car makers make the cars more efficient. The drivetrain, downsizing, turbocharging, gasoline, direct injection. One thing is I just changed the car from the conventional now to a direct injection, a gasoline car. It's fantastic, really, 15% lower consumption. That's very good. So the car manufacturers do their things. Our industry from the fuel side do what they can. 10-20% we can use renewable ethanol. I think 10% E10 for everybody is very easy. And I think also the oil stations should join us for, as we heard that here from left and right, maybe in 20, 30, 50 years, we don't need any oil station anymore. For we have totally different infrastructures, and it would be good for the fossil oil industry to say, well, let's join us with 10 or 20% renewables and keep the 80% fossil.
By the way, it would be great if some of you could be tweeting. The hashtag for this is GreenerEU. Hashtag GreenerEU. So jump in there and also try to jump in on the discussion here. We have about 20 minutes left. Pete, you wanted to add a word there before we go to our next question.
Yeah, well, the focus is on fuels. I mean, I think this is the answer to the question that Frank put out there earlier, is what do you do about the existing cars that are out there on the road? And clearly, decarbonizing fuels is an important solution for those. Now, the problem we have in Europe is that policymakers are very timid. Timid both in terms of ambition and in terms of sustainability. Yeah? And what have we got as a result of that timidness? We've got a biofuels policy that in 2020 is actually going to forecast to drive up emissions rather than reduce it. And there's a reason for that. If you look at the data on oil imports or vegetable oil imports, you find that all of the growth since 2010 has come from imported palm oil. So because policymakers weren't tough enough on sustainability, we end up getting biofuels that are driving up emissions instead of driving them down, and they're delivering no benefits for European farmers or for European energy security. Now, what we need for 2030 is a proper fuels policy that actually drives investment in the fuels we want. And those are sustainable advanced biofuels, predominantly from waste and residues. It's been shown that they can make a very significant greenhouse gas saving. It could even come from e-fuels. It may not be bio in the end, frankly. But the fact is that you won't get bio or non-bio unless you have a strong policy that provides strong incentives, but also strong guarantees of sustainability, because we believe that the two go together. You don't get investment security without getting sustainability security. And I think the experience of the last few years has proved that beyond doubt.
Before we go to Gesine, because you threw down the gauntlet for Gesine, unless you're a timid policymaker, then that's okay, I guess. But can we go to this gentleman? Please identify yourself.
Hi, thanks, Chris. Robert Wright, Secretary General of ePure. I'm glad the conversation is getting back to decarbonizing fuels, because I'm glad to hear all of the other options for the future. I'm glad to hear about alternative infrastructure. And, you know, what you're talking about there is using carbon more efficiently. I like the comments from Frank about what we do about the existing fuel infrastructure, the fuel today, not just looking only to the future of electric vehicles, because really we have between now and 2030 to meet some very, very ambitious targets with 40% greenhouse gas reductions. And I think given the data point that Pete's just mentioned with regard to the European Environment Agency's report today, transport's crucial. Now, we can only not just talk about transport in terms of the future options, electric vehicles, that's all good. We actually have to decarbonize the fuel today, the liquid fuel today in the passenger car. Because I've been here before, where we talk about a lot of things in Brussels about the future, options for the future, new technologies, alternatives. Why don't we also promote the alternatives that exist today? So not only just advanced biofuels, but low-carbon fuels such as ethanol. Because basically, at the end of the day, it's proven and it shows that ethanol reduces greenhouse gas emissions by at least 60%. I just want to make sure that we don't start talking only about the future. We actually have to start promoting low-carbon fuels of today.
Okay, I can try to make it short. First of all, Pete, you said we have policymakers that are too timid. I'm not timid, that's why I'm here. I know that not everybody, maybe, for example, likes longer trucks, although I said that. And first of all, if you think policymakers are too timid, join policy. Candidate, run for a parliament and try to change it. No, really, that's what comes to my mind, because it's quite a hard job to be a policymaker, you know. I don't want that you now feel sorry with me, not at all, because it's my decision to be there. But really, it's hard to, in a democracy, to find for good solutions. And what I really think, sometimes we have good solutions in place and the legislation is not implemented. So sometimes it's member states who are slowing down politicians as well. But it's a long story. I just don't want to be accused without somebody who is, who's willing to join me. And for this gentleman at the back, you just said right now, clean power transport strategy does only mean use carbon more efficient. That's not true. The clean power of transport strategy is on LNG, on CNG, on electricity, on hydrogen, and of course on ethanol as well. It's on all alternative energy you can use for transport. And if I talk about electricity, it might be as well wind energy or solar energy in future that could be put into the electric charging point. So really, it's not carbon, it's decarbonizing, yeah.
Okay, the questions are multiplying. If I could take the two on this side. There's one here, yes, and then one over here.
Yeah, hello, Chris Carroll, BAIC, European Consumer Organization. In these discussions about the sorts of measures that are needed to be implemented at the European level to decarbonise road transport, we often talk about the requirement to give industry certainty. I think there's also the need to provide consumers with certainty. We've talked about the need to roll out alternative fuels infrastructure, which of course is key with the rollout of more alternatively powered vehicles. But I think from the consumer perspective, we also have to think about the market itself, the sorts of vehicles that are available to consumers. Right now, there aren't so many alternatively powered vehicles available. And one of the ways of incentivizing car manufacturers to provide more vehicle types is for the setting of CO2 targets. We've seen what effect that has had on the market with the existing 2020 targets. But it's our position that it's important to set a subsequent target for passenger vehicles. We think it's important to set a 2025 target to ensure that there's a constant and seamless rollout of technologies post-2020. That will give consumers certainty. And, you know, it was mentioned earlier, the idea of setting a 2030 target. We think that's too far down the lane. We think you have to allow for that market to develop continuously after 2020. And starting along with that, I think Pete mentioned it, the need for providing consumers with more relevant, comparable, and reliable information, and that's another key aspect in this.
Okay, can you pose your question then? What is your question?
Well, as I said at the start, it's about what does the panel think about the measures needed to give consumers certainty in this area?
Okay, good. And the other question over here? Yes, sir. Yes.
Thank you, Chris. John Cooper from Fuels Europe. You're representing the petroleum refining industry, and I guess after all this debate, it's probably reasonable to have a little response from the folks that you want to put out of business, right? So can I just say something about the air quality challenge? And then I actually do have a question about how we know we're being cost-effective with the policies. So, Pete, I think we've exchanged before on different panels and things. I think you're absolutely right. We understand that there are different benefits of electrification. We still actually believe that the biggest benefit of electrification is CO2, for the simple reason that actually the Commission and the institutions of Europe have already done a great deal to answer the issues of air quality from the vehicles we have. Euro 6, real driving emissions, the new drive cycle, when they're fully implemented, you get vehicles that are incredibly clean. And actually, the European car industry has done a great job. Okay, we've had some bumps in the road, right? But you take a modern gasoline vehicle, and I would challenge people, if they're driving around the cities, to actually tell the difference between a modern gasoline hybrid vehicle that some of the time is switched off, some of the time is on electric drive, to actually tell the difference between an electric vehicle and a hybrid vehicle. I notice you actually did mention hybrid vehicle. We think the baseline for comparison actually should be the state of the art with the internal combustion engine hybridized in 2020 versus an electric vehicle, right? So if you start from that and you look at the cost benefits of electrification, the big one that still comes out actually is CO2. And we still come to policy costs of around 1,000 euros a ton at the moment. The battery costs are coming down, but the incentives, the calls for incentives go up. So we have very, very high costs of decarbonisation with electrification. That was our cost-benefit analysis. We haven't seen one from you. What I'd like to understand is, what kind of measures do we have to ensure that we've got cost-effectiveness in these policies? It's a huge challenge. We have to get there, but we don't have to go to only the solutions in European transport that are the most expensive. It's a global problem.
Okay, these two questions. Thank you very much. These two questions I like. Before we go to the others over here, can we get these answered? But I'd like to sort of spread around the comments. Alex, go ahead.
Maybe on the consumers' certainty. Yes, I can confirm that we will propose some targets for vehicles for the post 2020 period, and that of course will be important for consumer information purposes and drive into the market vehicles with low emissions. Also important to point that now with a new test cycle which has just been approved by a committee, relevant committee last week, we will get also better information for consumers on the actual CO2 emissions from vehicles. So I think that's a very important element. And finally, we are looking at how the current cars labeling directive is being implemented. So we will hopefully issue quite soon an evaluation of this directive.
Okay. Frank, does your mic work there?
Let's get you. That's why. No, that's why. Yeah, so I would like also to answer on the question, how can we give consumers certainty? And this was, again, only addressed towards the older industry and asking the regulators to push us somewhere. With regards to the new bright, shiny world of electric driving, the certainty has not to come from our side. The certainty has primarily come from the legislator's side.
What the customers really need is a clear plans, reliable plans. How in my environment will the infrastructure evolve within the next 1, 2, or 3, or 4, or 5 years? Because this is important. How will I get from Brussels to Amsterdam electrically? When will that be possible? And not only, well, we have some plans and somewhere in Europe, et cetera, cloudy, blah, blah. So that will not work. And if you can rely on that, then you can really decide, I buy such a car because for commuting purposes, this will work, for instance. Only then. Otherwise, you have a car and the commuting doesn't work.
And this debate over fuels, how do you stand on that?
Because we have these 240 million vehicles on the road, and it will take 20 years again for the cars which are today here on the road to get out of the market. They will use again fuels, and they need to use it as efficient as possible. Unfortunately, they are as they are from the day of today. So this means if you want to reduce their impact on the environment, you either have to educate the drivers in terms of patterns, or you have to improve the fuels you are fueling. And there are other technologies than only biofuels. There is also power-to-X technologies that are very costly, no doubt about that. But I think because of this long period of time, we will still work with combustion engines. We will need to do something.
Okay, thanks. Before we go, we got 4 questions over here. But Pete, please. You wanted to answer the
question. Yeah, thanks. Just to respond to John's question. I think John and I agree very much on the role of hybrids. There is a technology that is out there today that can deliver the kind of numbers that the Parliament put out there. The Parliament's Environment Committee said 2025 we should have a CO2 standard of 68 to 78 grams. Well, you can go out today and you can buy a Toyota Prius that does around 80. Give it another 10 years of technology development, and you're in that ballpark, you know, without needing to go to electrification. So there's been a lot of talk here about, you know, the challenges of infrastructure. Frankly, if you're just thinking about 2025 targets, you barely need it, actually. The technology is there. And we agree with John that that is highly efficient, optimal technology. To go from that very optimal state and then try to figure out the cost-benefit analysis, we could have a fascinating hour on that, but I think we've bored the audience to death. But essentially, it becomes very difficult to evaluate, you know, how do you value economic resilience, energy security? You know, do you start looking at the costs of, you know, patrolling the shipping lanes for oil? And those are big costs, by the way. So enough to say there are multiple benefits.
Right, thanks, Pete. I've got 7 minutes left, and I've got 4 questions. Let's see how much we can fit in. We're going to pack all 4 questions, and everybody try to answer. Yes, please.
Okay, I try to be fit.
Please identify yourself, too.
Yeah, I'm Michael Lehmann from Siemens Germany, and the future is not too far away, but just tomorrow, because we'll start an electric operation of a 40-ton truck on a public highway in Sweden. So how do you translate the ideas and the program you discussed now into the road transport sector?
Okay, thank you. That was a nice clip and claw. Thank you very much.
Yes, hi, Patrick Tembrink of the Institute of European Environmental Policy. I want to pick up on the consumer information issue, and also it's good to hear there's going to be a new test cycle, but the test cycle will only be so good. It probably won't totally match the real-world emissions. So what about learning from other areas and actually having a real-world emissions test, which could be linked to a car passport, which could be linked to your annual testing of your vehicles. Like that, you'd have an average annual efficiency, average energy efficiency, fuel efficiency values, CO2 values, which will then provide information for the second-hand car market and to improve driver behavior. So you actually empower the driver, improve the second-hand vehicle, and start addressing the larger swathe of the vehicles.
The real world.
And the technology is already there for many manufacturers, I've understood.
Okay. Next question, please.
I'll stand up. I'm Peter Teffer. I'm a journalist with EU Observer, and I have a question for Mr. Overmyer regarding this stick or carrot approach. Last April, the German Transport Ministry published a report after the Volkswagen scandal, and they found that the Mercedes V250 BlueTEC 2.1 had a defeat device, like many other cars, but they said, we can accept it if you adopt certain measures. And the car manufacturer agreed. My question is, why do you not design the car that way? Why do you have to wait for a transport ministry to say, you're polluting too much, please change your cars, and only then will you do it?
Okay, and final question, we have one over, yes sir, please.
Yeah, very inconvenient question for the end, because we didn't talk about the biggest sector in fuel consumption, which is the diesel sector. We're talking about electrification and we're talking about ethanol, but the biggest part of consumption is the diesel, and I haven't heard any solution tonight for the diesel sector. And I heard about CNG and stuff, and we're building infrastructure for that, but actually we're building infrastructure for another fossil fuel, which is, in the best case, 20% better than the ordinary fossil fuel. Are you serious about that? And sorry to wake you up from your dream. The diesel sector is the biggest issue that you have to solve, and I really have to ask for the solution here.
Gesine, please. Four questions.
I cannot have the solution for everything. I can start with the diesel sector. Well, of course, I know that the car industry is working hard on improving the diesel regarding emissions and NOx and so on. Well, I talked for hours on that because I'm in this inquiry committee and we're always concentrating on diesel technology. Well, of course, we have to take into account that diesel technology was really even supported in Europe because we wanted to reduce the CO2 emission. Everybody knows that. And then we didn't talk about NOx or something of that kind. Now we are facing everything and we have to think on improving that sector. That's maybe a short answer to you because I'm not a car builder. Just two more things. Michael talked about electric trucks in Sweden. That's a very good thing to hear about. And I think it's exactly what we have to go for. But as I said, the electricity must be produced in a sustainable way. That's always a question, where the electricity come from. And the test cycle that was here in the middle, of course, we are working on rear driving emission tests. That's what the Commission is right now working on. The Parliament is very impatient and wants to have it as soon as possible in place. I think consumers want it as well. And of course, you could say that you can combine annual testing with some information on the car owner on everything that really is the figure of the car regarding emission and fuel efficiency and so on. And driver education, that's what you mentioned. Well, that's already done right now. And that's, of course, where something, why so many people say self-driving cars could be by far better, because they don't need education. They are educated enough, so to say. I don't want to say that's the only solution, but it was tested that really they are more efficient, less emitting and so on. So, although I personally like to drive.
Gesine, thank you. So do I. Frank, a question pointed directly at Daimler, if you could answer that one. Why wait for the hammer to come down?
Wait for the hammer to come down. Yeah, so this basically has nothing to do with CO2. I mean, this is an emission problem with the ambient air emissions, and the case you have been addressing is a specific car, which is, it sounds a little bit like blaming others. However, this engine is developed together with Renault, and Renault had some discussions with the government in France, and they said, well, we see some opportunity to improve our engine after certain lessons of learning, and this is the same adjustment we will now do also. But we also need to know, if we have this RDE debate here around all this measuring of this PEMs, NICE, and testing facilities, we need to know that this type of testing devices are available on the market in that size that you really can do what we are seeing now in the last 1.5 year for 2 or 3 years maximum. So if you are now testing a vehicle then with an engine which is 6 to 8 years old, then this engine has been developed at this point in time where it was impossible to do such a testing. The RDE testing or the PEMS testing was invented for the heavy-duty sector. There we started that. And why did we start that? Because this complex analytical hardware was so huge that you needed a truck to put it on it and to be able to test it. And then we saw what we see with electronics and other devices. It shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And now we have a size that it is more or less handy. It's between 50 and 250 kilograms. Now you can mount it on a vehicle. vehicle. Now you can do all the tests. And that is, by the way, the reason why the RDE regulation is so late, which is being blamed the EU Commission to have delayed it. No, they started where it was possible with the heavy duty sector from 2007 to 2011. And after this has been ready, they switched to the passenger cars. And in parallel, the technology progressed so much that it was possible at all to do this testing. So please, an engine developed in 2010 or 2008, we have tests of Euro 5 vehicles from 2004. And now checking with modern methods and technologies and blaming them, say, you are stupid guys, why don't you develop it right from the beginning? Sorry, that was not possible. I'm an engineer, and I have to admit that. And from now on, the technology will improve dramatically due to several other developments. But this is history, and we have to live up to that.
Thanks, Frank. What about this real-world question, Pete? I mean, how do you answer that? How do you integrate that into planning ahead? Because there are arguments that, well, the testing used for autos right now is not reflecting the real conditions. Pete?
Yeah, I think it's very simple, real-world testing. What I'd like to answer is the diesel question. When we're talking about heavy-duty vehicles, you have to look around the world and you see that the US is just about to move with phase 2 standards, CO2 standards for trucks, yeah, like we don't have in Europe. Yeah, China is moving to phase 3. I forget where Japan is, but the fact is that Europe is seriously lagging. Now, I would encourage everyone who is interested in transport emissions to watch very, very closely when the US announces its phase 2, because it will be a shock. And if people can argue now that that European truck companies can compete on efficiency, then you'll see the driver that the US is going to be pulling ahead from here on out. Now, when it comes to passenger vehicles, the question of the diesel problem is a very European question. I mean, if you went to the US and said, what about the diesel question? They'd be, what? Yeah, I mean, if it's the same in Japan, yeah? They've chosen gasoline hybrid as the solution, yeah? 1 in 20 new cars sold in the rest of the world is a diesel. In Europe, it's more or less 1 in 2. What we've done is we've created this niche, this European niche of specialization, which we can't sell elsewhere around the world. Now, fortunately, citizens are waking up to that. We had a peak of diesel of around 56% in 2011. ASEA's first quarter report shows that for the first time in many, many years, it's now dipped below 50%. And a lot of that is thanks to the Volkswagen scandal. So thanks, Volkswagen, for that. People seem to be waking up to the fact that diesel is not the solution for the future.
Joachim, we're in overtime now. If I can test your patience a little bit for the next couple of minutes, we get final comments from Joachim and also from Alex, please. Joachim, I guess... Well, all these questions would be great to answer, but pick one or two.
Yeah, to your remark here right over there about diesel, why don't we talk about diesel now? Indeed, you answered that, Pete. Well, maybe there's a hard solution on cleaning up diesel or biodiesel. So it's the same problem with that. So looking forward, just to say that, if we look at the federal German statistics, the year 2015, new registered car, diesel and gasoline cars have exactly the same emission of carbon dioxide, 135 grams. So the theory that the diesel is a cleaner CO2 car is clearly not visible anymore. 10 years ago, it might be. For me, the future for the fleet, for the large fleet, 230 to 240 million cars is. The gasoline types is E10, and looking forward, we have that with the hybrid. The gasoline hybrid thing, I think, is for the new car, for the next 10 years, the best solution. And then we can combine that with E10, E20, better to say, E20. And if you add everything together with a certified carbon dioxide reduction of 60%, with the torque you have, with starting up the engine, you combine the electric engine, but you have the energy reserve of a gasoline car. I think for the next 10 years, that's a bridging technology, and then maybe we have a better battery technology to solve the problem. Right now, E10, E20, I think, is the best solution.
Alex, final comments, again, to those questions or any others?
Yeah, thanks a lot. Maybe to pick up on the real-world emissions. First of all, the good news about this new test cycle is that the gap between the real-world emission and the test will decrease substantially. So that's the good news. But there will still be some gap, and the challenge will be to ensure that we monitor very well this gap and that it doesn't increase in the future. Second point, whether we should go like we do for NOx for real driving emission tests. And I think there we're looking at the issue. It's quite different, NOx and CO2. NOx, you have a limit that you shall not exceed, whereas CO2, as we know, it will very much depend on how you drive, which if you drive in the city or motorway and so on. So we'll have to see what are the technical possibilities. And we've asked our scientific advisory committee within the commission to look into the topic. So I think in the next months and years, we will be looking at that.
Great. I think a quite intense discussion. Hopefully we can continue this with a cocktail afterward. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's give a big hand to Pete Harrison, Joachim Lutz, Gesine Meissner, Frank Overmeyer, Alex Paco, and my name is Chris Burns. And this is also part of the series of Friends of Europe called Greener EU. If you could tweet on this, hashtag GreenerEU. Thanks very much.